Welcome to the Cory Doctorow podcast. If it sounds a little different today, it's because I'm in the bathroom with my pregnant fiance who has hurt her back and is having a warm bath and asked me to read to her. We've been out shopping for baby clothes with my parents who are in town, and we're now home and taking it easy. So without wasting more time, I will read to you from Mr. Sterling's wonderful book, The Hacker Crackdown. For the neophyte, one of the most puzzling aspects of the crackdown on hackers is why the United States Secret Service has anything at all to do with this matter. The Secret Service is best known for its primary public role. Its agents protect the President of the United States. They also guard the President's family, the Vice President and his family, former presidents, and presidential candidates. They sometimes guard foreign dignitaries who are visiting the United States, especially foreign heads of state, and have been known to accompany American officials on diplomatic missions overseas. Special agents of the Secret Service don't wear uniforms, but the Secret Service has two uniformed police agencies. There's the former White House Police, now known as the Secret Service Uniform Division, since they currently guard foreign embassies in Washington, as well as the White House itself, and then there's the Uniformed Treasury Police Force. The Secret Service has been charged by Congress with a number of little-known duties. They guard the precious metals in the Treasury vaults. They guard the most valuable historical documents of the United States, originals of the Constitution, the Declaration of Independence, Lincoln's second inaugural address, an American-owned copy of the Magna Carta, and so forth. Once they were assigned to guard the Mona Lisa on her American tour in the 1960s. The entire Secret Service is a division of the Treasury Department. Secret Service special agents, there are about 1,900 of them, are bodyguards for the President et al., but they all work for the Treasury. And the Treasury, through its divisions of the U.S. Mint and Bureau of Engraving and Printing, prints the nation's money. As Treasury Police, the Secret Service guards the nation's currency. It is the only federal law enforcement agency with direct jurisdiction over counterfeiting and forgery. It analyzes documents for authenticity, and its fight against fake cash is still quite lively, especially since skilled counterfeiters of Medellin, Colombia have gotten into the act. Government checks, bonds, and other obligations, which exist in untold millions and are worth untold billions, are common targets for forgery, which the Secret Service also battles. It even handles forgery of postage stamps. But cash is fading in importance today, as money has become electronic. As necessity beckoned, the Secret Service moved from fighting the counterfeiting of paper currency and the forging of checks to the protection of funds transferred by wire. From wire fraud, it was a simple skip and jump to what is formally known as access fraud device. Congress granted the Secret Service the authority to investigate access device fraud under Title 18 of the United States Code, U.S. Code Section 1029. The term access device seems intuitively simple. It's some kind of high-tech gizmo you use to get money with. It makes good sense to put this sort of thing in the charge of counterfeiting and wire fraud experts. However, in Section 1029, the term access device is very generously defined. An access device is any card, plate, code, account number, or other means of account access that can be used, alone or in conjunction with another access device, to obtain money, goods, services, or any other thing of value, or that can be used to initiate a transfer of funds. Access device can therefore be construed to include credit cards themselves, a popular forgery item nowadays, but they also include credit card account numbers, those standards of the digital underground. The same goes for telephone charge cards, an increasingly popular item with telcos who are tired of being robbed of pocket change by phone booth thieves. And also telephone access codes, those other standards of the digital underground. Stolen telephone codes may not obtain money, but they certainly do obtain valuable services, which is specifically forbidden under Section 1029. We can now see that Section 1029 already pits the United States Secret Service directly against the digital underground, without any mention at all of the word computer. Standard phreaking devices, like blue boxes, used to steal phone service from old-fashioned mechanical switches, are unquestionably counterfeit access devices. Thanks to Section 1029, it is not only illegal to use counterfeit access devices, it is also illegal to build them. Producing, designing, duplicating, or assembling blue boxes are all federal crimes today, and if you do this, the Secret Service has been charged by Congress to come after you. Automatic teller machines, which replicated all over America during the 1980s, are definitely access devices too, and an attempt to tamper with their punch-in codes and plastic bank cards falls directly under Section 1029. Section 1029 is remarkably elastic. Suppose you find a computer password in someone's trash. That password might be a code. It's certainly a means of account access. Now, suppose you log onto a computer and copy some software for yourself. You've certainly obtained service, computer service, and a thing of value, the software. Suppose you tell a dozen friends about your swipe password and let them use it too. Now you're trafficking in unauthorized access devices. And when the Prophet, a member of the Legion of Doom, passed a stolen telephone company document to Night Lightning at Frack Magazine, they were both charged under Section 1029. There are two limitations on Section 1029. First, the offense must affect interstate or foreign commerce in order to become a matter of foreign jurisdiction. The term affecting commerce is not well defined, but you may take it as a given that the Secret Service can take an interest if you've done most anything that happens to cross a state line. State and local police can be touchy about their jurisdictions and can sometimes be mulish when the feds show up, but when it comes to computer crime, the local police are pathetically grateful for federal help. In fact, they complain that they can't get enough of it. If you're stealing long-distance service, you're almost certainly crossing state lines, and you're definitely affecting interstate commerce of the telcos. And if you're abusing credit cards by ordering stuff out of glossy catalogs from, say, Vermont, you're in for it. The second limitation is money. As a rule, the feds don't pursue penny ante offenders. Federal judges will dismiss cases that appear to waste their time. Federal crimes must be serious. Section 1029 specifies a minimum loss of $1,000. The second limit, we now come to the very next section of Title 18, which is Section 1030, Fraud and Related Activity in Connection with Computers. This statute gives the Secret Service direct jurisdiction over acts of computer intrusion. On the face of it, the Secret Service would now seem to command the field. Section 1030, however, is nowhere near so ductile as Section 1029. The first annoyance is Section 1030D, which reads, "The United States Secret Service shall, in addition to any other agency having such authority, have the authority to investigate offenses under this section. Such authority of the United States Secret Service shall be exercised in accordance with an agreement which shall be entered into by the Secretary of the Treasury and the Attorney General." Author's emphasis. The Secretary of the Treasury is the titular head of the Secret Service, while the Attorney General is in charge of the FBI. In Section D, Congress shrugged off responsibility for the computer crime turf battle between the service and the Bureau and made them fight it out all by themselves. The result was a rather dire one for the Secret Service, for the FBI ended up with exclusive jurisdiction over computer break-ins having to do with national security, foreign espionage, federally insured banks, and U.S. military bases, while retaining joint jurisdiction over all other computer intrusions. Essentially, when it comes to Section 1030, the FBI not only gets the real glamour stuff for itself, but can peer over the shoulder of the Secret Service and barge into meddle whenever it suits them. The second problem has to do with the dicey term federal interest computer. Section 1030A2 makes it illegal to access a computer without authorization if that computer belongs to a financial institution or an issuer of credit cards, fraud cases in other words. Congress was quite willing to give the Secret Service jurisdiction over money transferring computers, but Congress balked at letting them investigate any and all computer intrusions. Instead, the USSS had to settle for the money machines and federal interest computers. A federal interest computer is a computer which the government itself owns or is using. Large networks of interstate computers linked over state lines are also considered to be of federal interest. This notion of federal interest is rather foggy and has never been clearly defined in the courts. The Secret Service has never yet had its hand slapped for investing computer break-ins that were not of federal interest, but conceivably, someday this might happen. So the Secret Service's authority over unauthorized access to computers covers a lot of territory, but by no means the whole ball of cyberspatial wax. If you are, for example, a local computer retailer or the owner of a local bulletin board system, then a malicious local intruder can break in, crash your system, trash your files and scatter viruses, and the U.S. Secret Service cannot do a single thing about it. At least it can't do anything directly. But the Secret Service will do plenty to help the local people who can. The FBI may have dealt itself an ace off the bottom of the deck when it comes to Section 1030, but that's not the whole story. That's not the street. What Congress thinks is one thing, and Congress has been known to change its mind. The real turf struggle is out there on the streets and where it's happening. If you're a local street cop with a computer problem, the Secret Service wants you to know that you can find real expertise with them. While the bureau crowd are off having their favorite shoes polished, wingtips, and making derisive fun of the service's favorite shoes, pansy-ass tassels, the tassel-toting Secret Service has a crew of ready and able hacker trackers installed in the capital of every state in the Union. Need advice? They'll give you advice, or at least point you in the right direction. Need training? They can see to that, too. If you're a local cop and you call on the FBI, the FBI, as is widely and slanderously rumored, will order you around like a coolie, take all the credit for your busts, and mop up every scrap of reflected glory. The Secret Service, on the other hand, doesn't brag a lot. They're quiet types. Very quiet. Very cool. Efficient. High tech. Mirror shades, icy stares, radio earplugs, and an Uzi machine pistol tucked somewhere in their well-cut jackets. American samurai, sworn to give their lives to protect our president. The Granite Agents, trained in martial arts, absolutely fearless. Every single one of them has a top-secret security clearance. Something goes a little wrong, you're not going to hear any whining and moaning and political buck-passing out of these guys. The facade of the Granite Agent is, of course, not the reality. Secret Service agents are human beings, and the real glory in service work is not battling computer crime, not yet anyway, but in protecting the president. The real glamour of Secret Service work is in the White House detail. If you're at the president's side, then the kids and the wife see you on television. You rub shoulders with the most powerful people in the world. That's the real heart of service work, the number one priority. More than one computer investigation has stopped dead in the water when the service agents vanished at the president's need. There's romance in the work of the service, the intimate access to circles of great power, the esprit de corps of a highly trained and disciplined elite, the high responsibility of defending the chief executive, the fulfillment of a patriotic duty. And as police work goes, the pay's not bad. But there's squalor in service work, too. You may get spat upon by protesters howling abuse, and if they get violent, if they get too close, sometimes you have to knock one of them down. Discreetly. The real squalor in service work is drudgery such as the quarterlies, traipsing out four times a year, year in, year out, to interview various pathetic wretches, many of them in prisons and asylums, who have seen fit to threaten the president's life. And then there's the grinding stress of searching all those faces in the endless bustling crowds, looking for hatred, looking for psychosis, looking for the tight, nervous face of an Arthur Bremer, a Squeaky Fromm, a Lee Harvey Oswald. It's watching all those grasping, waving hands for sudden movements while your ears strain at your radio headphone for the long-rehearsed cry of GUN! It's poring in grinding detail over the biographies of every rotten loser who ever shot at a president. It's the unsung work of the protective research section who studies scrawled, anonymous death threats with all the meticulous tools of anti-forgery techniques. It's maintaining the hefty, computerized files on anyone who ever threatened the president's life. Civil libertarians have become increasingly concerned at the government's use of computer files to track American citizens. But the Secret Service's file of potential presidential assassins, which has upwards of 20,000 names, rarely causes a peep of protest. If you ever state that you intend to kill the president, the Secret Service will want to know and record who you are, where you are, and what you're up to. If you're a serious threat, if you're officially considered of protective interest, then the Secret Service may well keep tabs on you for the rest of your natural life. Protecting the president has first call on all the service's resources, but there's a lot more to the service's traditions and history than standing guard outside the Oval Office. The Secret Service is the nation's oldest general federal law enforcement agency. Compared to the Secret Service, the FBI are new hires and the CIA are temps. The Secret Service was founded way back in 1865 at the suggestion of Hugh McCullough, Abraham Lincoln's Secretary of the Treasury. McCullough wanted a specialized Treasury police to combat counterfeiting. Abraham Lincoln agreed that this seemed like a good idea, and with a terrible irony, Abraham Lincoln was shot that very night by John Wilkes Booth. The Secret Service originally had nothing to do with protecting presidents. They didn't take this on as a regular assignment until after the Garfield assassination in 1888. And they didn't get any congressional money for it until President McKinley was shot in 1901. The service was originally designed for one purpose, destroying counterfeiters. There are interesting parallels between the service's 19th century entry into counterfeiting and America's 20th century entry into computer crime. In 1865, America's paper currency was in a terrible muddle. Security was drastically bad. Currency was printed on the spot by local banks in literally hundreds of different designs. No one really knew what the heck a dollar bill was supposed to look like. Bogus bills passed easily. If some joker told you that a $1 bill from the Railroad Bank of Lowell, Massachusetts had a woman leaning on a shield with a locomotive, a cornucopia, a compass, various agricultural instruments, a railroad bridge, and some factories, you pretty much had to take his word for it. And in fact, he was telling the truth. 1,600 local American banks designed and printed their own paper currency, and there were no general standards for security. Like a badly guarded node in a computer network, badly designed bills were easy to fake and posed a security hazard for the entire monetary system. No one knew the exact extent of the threat to the currency. There were panicked estimates that as much as a third of the national currency was faked. Counterfeiters, known as boodlers in the underground slang of the time, were mostly technically skilled printers who had gone to the bad. Many had once worked printing legitimate currency. Boodlers operated in rings and gangs. Technical experts engraved the bogus plates, commonly in basements in New York City. Smooth confidence men passed large wads of high-quality, high-denomination fakes, including the really sophisticated stuff, government bonds, stock certificates, and railway shares. Cheaper, botched fakes were sold or sharewared to low-level gangs of boodler wannabes. The real cheesy low-life boodlers merely upgraded real bills by altering their face values, changing ones to fives, tens to hundreds, and so on. The techniques of boodling were little known and regarded with a certain awe by the mid-19th century public. The ability to manipulate the system for rip-off seemed diabolically clever. As the skill and daring of the boodlers increased, the situation became intolerable. The federal government stepped in and began offering its own federal currency, which was printed in fancy green ink, but only on the back, the original greenbacks. And at first, the improved security of the well-designed, well-printed federal greenbacks seemed to solve the problem. But then the counterfeiters caught on. Within a few years, things were worse than before. A centralized system where all the security was bad. The local police were helpless. The government tried offering blood money to potential informants, but this met with little success. Banks, plagued with boodling, gave up hope of police help and hired private security men instead. Merchants and bankers queued up by the thousands to buy privately printed manuals on currency security, slim little books like Laban Heath's Infallible Government Counterfeit Detector. The back of the book offered Laban Heath's patent microscope for $5. Then the Secret Service entered the picture. The first agents were a rough-and-ready crew. Their chief was one William P. Wood, a former guerrilla in the Mexican War who'd won a reputation for busting contractor fraudsters for the War Department during the Civil War. Wood, who was also keeper of the Capitol Prison, had a sideline as a counterfeiting expert, bagging boodlers for the federal bounty money. Wood was named chief of the new Secret Service in July 1865. There were only 10 Secret Service agents in all, Wood himself, a handful who'd worked for him in the War Department, and a few former private investigators, counterfeiting experts, whom Wood had won over to the public service. The Secret Service of 1865 was much the size of the Computer Fraud and Abuse Task Force or the Arizona Racketeering Unit of 1990. These 10 operatives had an additional 20 or so assistant operatives and informants. Besides salary and per diem, each Secret Service employee received a whopping $25 for each boodler he captured. Wood himself publicly estimated that at least half of America's currency was counterfeited, a perhaps pardonable perception. Within a year, the Secret Service had arrested over 200 counterfeiters. They busted about 200 boodlers a year for 4 years straight. Wood attributed his success to traveling fast and light, hitting the bad guys hard, and avoiding bureaucratic baggage. Because my raids were made without military escort, and I did not ask the assistance of state officers, I surprised the professional counterfeiter. Wood's social message to the once impudent boodlers bore an eerie ring of Sun Devil. It was also my purpose to convince such characters that it would no longer be healthy for them to ply their vocation without being handled roughly, a fact that they soon discovered. William P. Wood, the Secret Service's guerrilla pioneer, did not end well. He succumbed to the lure of aiming for the really big score. The notorious Brockway gang of New York City, headed by William E. Brockway, the King of the Counterfeiters, had forged a number of government bonds. They'd passed these brilliant fakes on the prestigious Wall Street investment firm of J. Cook & Company. The Cook firm were frantic and offered a huge reward for the forger's plates. Laboring diligently, Wood confiscated the plates, though not Mr. Brockway, and claimed the reward. But the Cook Company treacherously reneged. Wood got involved in a down-and-dirty lawsuit with the Cook capitalists. Wood's boss, Secretary of the Treasury McCullough, felt that Wood's demands for money and glory were unseemly, and even when the reward money finally came through, McCullough refused to pay Wood anything. Wood found himself mired in the seemingly endless round of federal suits and congressional lobbying. Wood never got his money. He lost his job to boot. He resigned in 1869. Wood's agents suffered, too. On May 12, 1869, the second chief of the Secret Service took over and almost immediately fired most of Wood's pioneer Secret Service agents, operatives, assistants, and informants alike. The practice of receiving $25 per crook was abolished, and the Secret Service began the long, uncertain process of thorough professionalization. Wood ended badly. He must have felt stabbed in the back. In fact, his entire organization was mangled. On the other hand, William P. Wood was the first head of the Secret Service. William Wood was the pioneer. People still honor his name. Who remembers the name of the second head of the Secret Service? As for William Brockway, also known as Colonel Spencer, he was finally arrested by the Secret Service in 1880. He did 5 years in prison, got out, and was still boodling at the age of 74. Anyone with an interest in Operation Sun Devil, or in American computer crime generally, could scarcely miss the presence of Gale Thackeray, Assistant Attorney General of the state of Arizona. Computer crime training manuals often cited Thackeray's group and her work. She was the highest-ranking state official to specialize in computer-related offenses. Her name had been on the Sun Devil press release, though modestly ranked well after the local prosecuting attorney and the head of the Phoenix Secret Service office. As public commentary and controversy began to mount about the hacker crackdown, this Arizonan state official began to take a higher and higher public profile. Though uttering almost nothing specific about the Sun Devil operation itself, she coined some of the most striking sound bites of the growing propaganda war. "Agents are operating in good faith, and I don't think you can say that for the hacker community," was one. Another was the memorable, "I am not a mad dog prosecutor." Houston Chronicle, September 2, 1990. In the meantime, the Secret Service maintained its usual extreme discretion. The Chicago unit, smarting from the backlash of the Steve Jackson scandal, had gone completely to earth. As I collated my growing pile of newspaper clippings, Gale Thackeray ranked as a comparative font of public knowledge on police operations. Shortly after this, Gale Thackeray lost her job, and I temporarily misplaced my own career as a science fiction writer to become a full-time computer crime journalist. In early March 1991, I flew to Phoenix, Arizona to interview Gale Thackeray for my book on the hacker crackdown. "Credit cards didn't used to cost anything to get," says Gale Thackeray. "Now they cost $40, and that's just to cover the cost from rip-off artists." Electronic nuisance criminals are parasites. One by one, they're not much harm, no big deal. But they never come just one by one. They come in swarms, heaps, legions, sometimes whole subcultures. And they bite. Every time we buy a credit card today, we lose a little financial vitality to a particular species of bloodsucker. What, in her expert opinions, are the worst forms of electronic crime, I ask, consulting my notes. Is it credit card fraud? Breaking into ATM bank machines? Phone phreaking? Computer intrusions? Software viruses? Access code theft? Records tampering? Software piracy? Pornographic bulletin boards? Satellite TV piracy? Theft of cable service? It's a long list. By the time I reach the end of it, I feel rather depressed. "Oh no," says Gale Thackeray, leaning forward over the table, her whole body gone stiff with energetic indignation. "The biggest damage is telephone fraud, fake sweepstakes, fake charities, boiler room con operations. You could pay off the national debt with what those guys steal. They target old people. They get hold of credit ratings and demographics. They rip off the old and the weak." The words come tumbling out of her. "It's low-tech stuff, your everyday boiler room fraud. Grifters conning people out of money on the phone. It's been around for decades. This is where the word phony comes from. It's just that it's so much easier now, horribly facilitated by advances in technology and the Byzantine structure of the modern phone system. The same professional fraudsters do it over and over," Thackeray tells me, "and they hide behind dense onion shells of fake companies, fake holding corporations 9 or 10 layers deep, registered all over the map. They get a phone installed under a false name in an empty safe house, and then they call forward everything out of that phone to yet another phone, a phone that might even be in another state. And they don't even pay the charges on the phones. After a month or so, they just split, set up somewhere else in another Podunkville with the same seedy crew of veteran phone crooks. They buy or steal commercial credit card reports, slap them on a PC, have a program pick out people over 65 who pay a lot to charities. A whole subculture living off this. Merciless folks on the con. The light bulbs for blind people, Thackeray muses with a special loathing. There's just no end to them. We're sitting in a downtown diner in Phoenix, Arizona. It's a tough town, Phoenix. A state capital, seeing some hard times. Even to a Texan like myself, Arizona state politics seem rather baroque. There was and remains endless trouble over the Martin Luther King holiday, the sort of stiff-necked foot-shooting incident for which Arizona politics seem famous. There was Evan Meacham, the eccentric Republican millionaire governor who was impeached after reducing state government to a ludicrous shambles. Then there was the national Keating scandal involving Arizona savings and loans, in which both of Arizona's U.S. senators, DeConcini and McCain, played sadly prominent roles. And the very last is the latest bizarre as-scam case, in which state legislators were videotaped eagerly taking cash from an informant of the Phoenix City Police Department, who was posing as a Vegas mobster. "Oh," says Thackeray cheerfully, "those people are amateurs here. They thought they were finally getting to play with the big boys. They don't have the least idea how to take a bribe. It's not institutional corruption. It's not like back in Philly." Gail Thackeray was a former prosecutor in Philadelphia. Now she's a former Assistant Attorney General of the state of Arizona. Since moving to Arizona in 1986, she had worked under the aegis of Steve Twist, her boss in the Attorney General's office. Steve Twist wrote Arizona's pioneering computer crime laws and naturally took an interest in seeing them enforced. It was a snug niche, and Thackeray's organized crime and racketeering unit won a national reputation for ambition and technical knowledgeability, until the latest election in Arizona. Thackeray's boss ran for the top job and lost. The victor, the new attorney general, apparently went to some pains to eliminate the bureaucratic traces of his rival, including his pet group, Thackeray's group. 12 people got their walking papers. Now Thackeray's painstakingly assembled computer lab sits gathering dust somewhere in the glass and concrete attorney general's HQ on 1275 Washington Street. Her computer crime books, her painstakingly garnered back issues of freak and hacker zines, all bought at her own expense, are piled in boxes somewhere. The state of Arizona is simply not particularly interested in electronic racketeering at the moment. At the moment of our interview, Gail Thackeray is officially unemployed, is working out of the county sheriff's office, living on her savings, and prosecuting several cases, working 60-hour weeks, just as always, for no pay at all. "I'm trying to train people," she mutters. Half her life seems to be training people, merely pointing out to the naive and incredulous, such as myself, that this stuff is actually going on out there. It's a small world, computer crime. A young world. Gail Thackeray, a trim blonde baby boomer who favors Grand Canyon whitewater rafting to kill some slow time, is one of the world's most senior, most veteran hacker trackers. Her mentor was Don Parker, the California think tank theorist who got it all started way back in the mid-70s, the grandfather of the field, and the great bald eagle of computer crime. And what she has learned, Gail Thackeray teaches, endlessly, tirelessly, to anybody, to Secret Service agents and police, at the Glencoe, Georgia Federal Training Centers, to local police on roadshows with her slide projector and notebook, to corporate security personnel, to journalists, to parents.